Yeah, I did that.
We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is
self-destruction.
It really ain't the rap audience's bugging. It's one or two suckers, ignorant brothers, trying to rob and steal from one another. You get caught in the mid. So to crush that stereotype, here's what we did. We got ourselves together so that you could unite and fight for what's right. Not negative cause. The way we live is positive. We don't kill our relatives.
Pop, 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 when it's shot, who's to blame? Headlines, front page, and rap's the name. MC Delight here to state the bottom line. The black on black crime was way before our time.
Took a brother's life with a knife as his wife cried, cause he died a trifling death when he left his very last breath. Was I slept, so watch your step. Back in the 60s, our brothers and sisters were hanged. How could you gangbang? I never ever ran from the Ku Klux Klan, and I shouldn't have to run from a black man, cause that's
self-destruction. Yeah, it was self-destruction. Self-destruction. Yeah, it was self-destruction.
Funky fresh dress to impress, ready to party. Money in your pocket, dying to move your body. To get inside, you pay the whole $10. Scotch tape with a razor blade, tape to your collar. Leave the guns in the crack and the knobs alone. MC Lights on the microphone. Bum rushing and pushing, snatching and taxing. I crammed understand why brothers don't be maxing. There's only one disco, they'll close one more. You ain't guarding the door, so what you got a gun for? Do you rob the rich and give to the poor? Yo, daddy, yo.
Straight from the mouth of
why
and daddy o
do a crime,
end up in jail,
and gotta go.
Cause you could do crime and get paid today, and tomorrow you're behind bars in the worst way.
Far from your family,
cause you're locked away.
Now tell me,
do you really think crime pays?
Even on taking what your brother had?
You little sucker,
you talking all that jazz.
It's time to stand together in a unity, cause if not, then yo, we're soon to be self-destroyed, unemployed. D-rap race will be lost without a trace or a clue, but what to do is stop the violence and kick the science down the road that we call eternity, where knowledge is formed and you learn to be self-sufficient, independent. To teach the East is what rap intended, but society wants to invade, so do not walk this path that they laid. It
self-destruction. Yeah, it was self-destruction. Self-destruction.
D-Nice, break it down like this.
Children growing, women producing, men go work in sandals.
Self-destruction, you're heading for self-destruction. Self-destruction.
This is all about, no doubt, to stop violence. But first, let's have a moment of silence. Swing. Things been stated, re-educated, evaluated. Thoughts of the past have faded. The only thing left is the memories of our belated. And I hate it when someone dies to get all hurt up for a silly gold chain by Chump.
Word up.
It doesn't make you a big man. And to one and go and dish your brother, man. And you don't know that's part of the plan. Why? Because rap music is in full demand. Understand?
Self-destruction. Paying for self-destruction.
My name is Just Ice, a man, not a prankster. I was known as the gangster. But believe me, that is no fun. The time is now to unite everyone. You don't have to be soft to be for peace. Robbing and killing and murdering is the least. You don't have to be chained by the beast. But party people, it's time I release.
Hey yo, here's the situation. Any odyssey, nonsense, violence. Not a good policy, therefore we must ignore fighting, fussing. Heaven's at the door, so there'll be no bum rushing. Let's get together because we're falling apart. I heard a brother shot another, it broke my heart. I don't understand the difficulty. Love your brother. other. Treat them as an equal. They call us animals. I don't agree with them. I'll prove them wrong. But right is what you're proving them. Take heed before I leave to what I'm saying, or we'll all be on our knees praying.
Heavy deep, deep in the heart of the matter. The self-destruction is served on a platter. Making a day, not failing to anticipate. They got greedy, so they fell for the bait. That makes them a victim. Pick them, pluck. New jack in jail, but to the vets, they're a duck. There's no one around, cause in jail, you're a number. They never took the time to wonder about
self-destruction. You're headed for self-destruction.
To merge, we live for the love of our people, the hope to get along.
Yeah, so we get a song.
Getting a point to our brothers and sisters who don't know the time.
Boy, so we run around.
Instead in your head, you know our job to build and collect ourselves with intellect.
Come on.
To revolve, to evolve the self-respect.
Cause we got to keep ourselves in check.
Or else it's
self-destruction. You're headed for self-destruction. Self-destruction.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
We're poor, Ashe.
Ashe.
We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe.
Ashe.
We poor to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it. Whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who grade the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves, became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, stop, no more. We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names.
Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Davis Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X,
John
Henry Clark, Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. My name is Dr. William Rogers, and I am your host for the evening. I'm so happy that you are able to join us. I really say that with sincerity. I'm so happy that you all are here, which means that I think most of you are doing well, and that the difficulties that we are having right now in our world is truly, truly challenging. So happy that you are able to join us and that you're doing well and you're staying safe. And I pray that that continues to follow you, that the ancestors, that the Creator protect you through this very difficult times that we are in. We're so happy that you're here. We thought maybe tonight we would look at as something that sort of speaks to a lot of what we're saying, is that how do we build a new world for ourselves and our children and those that are coming behind us. And so we want to kind of talk about that a little bit. We appreciate so much, as I said, those of you who have made some suggestions in terms of what we need to do. And so this is one of the things that we want to look at tonight. And we have our wonderful friends that are online that I know. So I'm going to not prolong a lot of our discussion. I want to get right into the matter. As always, we want to do our ancestral profile that we always do. And tonight I am going to talk about a sister whose name is Rebecca Lee Crumpler. Rebecca Lee Crumpler. Rebecca Lee Crumpler was born February the 8th, 1831, and she transitioned on March the 9th, 1895. She was an African-American physician and an author. And after studying at New England Female Medical College in 1864, she was the first African-American woman to become a doctor of medicine in the United States of America. Mrs. Crumpler, Dr. Crumpler, graduated from medical college at a time when very few African-Americans were allowed to even attend college, much less medical college, or either publish books. Dr. Crumpler first practiced medicine in Boston, primarily for poor women and children. After the American Civil War ended in 1865, she moved to Richmond, Virginia, believing treatment and offering treatment to women and children. She felt that this was an ideal way to perform missionary work. Dr. Crumpler worked for the Freedmen's Bureau to produce medical care to the recently enslaved freed Africans. She was subject to intense racism and sexism while practicing medicine. The great need for medical providers encouraged other African people to join the medical profession. Black charitable organizations and white missionary organizations provided funding for the first black medical college. She later moved back to Boston to continue to treat women and children. And in 1883, she published a book of medical discourses. It was dedicated to nurses and to mothers. It focused on the medical care of women and children and was one of the first publications written by an African-American about medicine. Dr. Crumpler was, in fact, the only female physician author in the 19th century, either white or black. She was, there were several free health clubs that were named in her honor. One was called the Rebecca Lee Pre-Health Society at Syracuse University, and the Rebecca Lee Society, which was one of the first medical societies for African-American women, that was named after her. Her Joy Street House, which is located in Boston, is a stop on what is known as the Boston Women's Heritage Trail. Wonderful, beautiful sister, Dr. Rebecca Lee Crumpler. Okay, thank you so much for that. Tonight we are talking about the beloved community. The beloved community was an idea that was posed by the great Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in a speech, sort of surmising all of the work that he had been doing and what he saw was necessary to do that. We have, I really appreciate Sister Benicia Ayan, who has quite often hosted program with me and done some things. She has been very active in helping me formulate programs and ideas. And so tonight this was her suggestion. And we're going to bring her on in a minute, and we're going to talk about the beloved community. But before we do that, I want you to hear this speech by Dr. King and to just kind of let's launch off into our discussion from this particular narrative by him. And let's listen to that now.
The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. And this is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and peace. Let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters. Oh, my friends, our aim must be not to defeat Mr. Engelhardt, not to defeat Mr. Shallison, Mr. Gale, And Mr. Parks, I must be to defeat the evil that's in them. But I must be to win the friendship of Mr. Gale and Mr. Sellers and Mr. Englehart. We must come to the point of seeing that our ultimate aim is to live with all men as brothers and sisters under God and not be their enemies or anything that goes with that type of relationship. I'm coming to the conclusion now. Garner reminds us that freedom never comes on a silver platter. It's never easy. Garner reminds us that whenever you break out of Egypt, you better get ready for stiff battle. You better get ready for some homes to be bombed. You better get ready for some churches to be bombed. You better get ready for a lot of nasty things to be said about you, because you're getting out of Egypt, and whenever you break loose from Egypt, the initial response of the Egyptian is bitterness. It never comes with ease. It comes only through the hardness and persistence of life. And freedom never comes easy. It comes through hard labor, and it comes through toil. It comes through hours of despair and disappointment. That's the way it goes. That is no crown without a cross. I wish we could get to Easter without going to Good Friday, but history tells us that we got to go by Good Friday before we can get to Easter. That's the long story of freedom, isn't it? Before you get to Cana, you got a Red Sea to confront. You have a hardened heart of a Pharaoh to confront. You have the prodigious hilltops of evil in the wilderness to confront. And even when you get up to the promised land, you have giants in the land. The beautiful thing about it is that there are few people who've been over in the land. They have spied enough to say, even though the giants are there, we can possess the land, because we got the internal fiber to stand up amid anything that we have to face. The road to freedom is a difficult, hard road. But something else came to my mind. God comes in the picture even when the church won't take a stand. God has injected a principle in this universe. God has said that all men must respect the dignity and worth of all human personality. And if you don't do that, I will take charge. It seems this morning that I can hear God speaking. I can hear him speaking throughout the universe, saying, be still and know that I'm God. And if you don't stop, if you don't straighten up, if you don't stop extorting people, I'm going to rise up and break the backbone of your power. And your power will be no more in the power. And I say to you this morning, my friends, rise up and know that as you struggle for justice, you do not struggle alone, but God struggles with you. And he's working every day. Somehow I can look out. I can look out across the seas and across the universe and cry out, my eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He's tramping out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. Then I think about it, because his truth is marching on, and I can sing another chorus. Hallelujah. Glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. Then I can hear Isaiah again, because that has profound meaning to me. That somehow every valley shall be exalted and every hill shall be made low. The plain, the crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. And that's the beauty of this thing. All flesh shall see it together. Not some from the heights of Park Street and others from the dungeons of slum areas. Not some from the pinnacles of the British Empire and some from the dark deserts of Africa. Not some from inordinate superfluous wealth and others from abject deadening poverty. Not some white and not some black. Not some yellow and not some brown. But all flesh shall see it together. They shall see it from Montgomery. They shall see it from New York. They shall see it from Ghana. They shall see it from China. For I can look out and see a great number as John saw marching into the great eternity. Because God is working in this world and at this hour and at this moment. And God grant that we will get on board and start marching with God. Because we got orders now to break down the bondage and the walls of colonialism, exploitation, and imperialism. To break them down to the point that no man will trample over another man, but that all men will respect the dignity and worth of all human personality. And then we will be in Canaan's freedom land. Moses might not get to see Canaan, but his children will see it. He even got to the mountaintop enough to see it, and that assured him that it was coming. But the beauty of the thing is that there's always a just way to take up his work and take the children on in. And it's there waiting with its milk and honey and with all of the bountiful beauty that God has in store for his children. Oh, what exceedingly marvelous things God has in store for us. Granted, we will follow him enough to gain them. Oh, God, our gracious Heavenly Father, help us to see the insights that come from this new nation. Help us to follow thee and all of thy creative work in this world. That somehow we will discover that we are made to live together as brothers. And that it will come in this generation, the day when all men we recognize the fatherhood of God.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Very clearly a voice from the ancestors, a voice that is awakening and so appropriate to what we are seeing today. We are seeing a world that is of biblical proportion. And we all must wake ourselves up and realize what's happening and what's going on around us. And so we thank Dr. Martin Luther King for those words. This was done at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church back in the 50s. But it's so appropriate for today. So tonight we have fashioned our discussion question as, is the beloved community that was envisioned by Dr. King possible in our time? Is it possible in our time? And as we indicated, Dr. King's beloved community was a notion that he popularized based on the struggles of the civil rights movement at the time. And he considered it as a society that was based on justice, equal opportunity, and love of one's fellow human beings. And he warned us in other writings. He said, if we do not learn to live together as brothers and sisters, we will die as fools. So the question we are asking our audience and our panel tonight, is a beloved community possible in the age of 45, declining stock markets, high unemployment, the coronavirus, et cetera, and so many other things that are going on around us? Can a beloved community be created? And if so, how and by who? So with that, we are going to launch into our discussion. As I indicated earlier, my good sister, Sister Benicia Ayan, brought this idea to me and said, this is something I think we should discuss. She would like to discuss it. So I'm going to start off with her. I know she's online. Sister Ayan, I want to ask you, what made you think about that topic and thought maybe that might be relevant for us to talk about? Just kind of give us an update on that whole, the energy behind you deciding to do that, because it's so very appropriate.
Well, first I want to say, of course, greetings and Hotep, peace and love to everyone. I don't need to give all of those, but I'm just going to stick with one. I'll just say peace and love to all that are usually on the call and those that might be listening. So what, and how are you doing, Doc, tonight?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Thank you so much.
Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah. I'm glad you're doing this tonight, because I think some of us might be feeling isolated since they have this thing going on now.
Yes.
You know, with this isolation, asking people to isolate themselves. But so what motivated me to think about this, throughout our conversations, across the past year or so, mm-hmm. on Black Reality Think Tank, one of the brothers, and that's Brother Pugh,
yes.
makes mention of the beloved community fairly often.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever he mentions that, I think about an organization that I was a part of and I still, you know, I'm associated with. And there's an actual organization here where I am in the South called the Beloved Community Center. And this organization models itself after Dr. King's vision of, you know, justice, equality, and a connection of the human family coming together as one. And then I also was a member of the Baha'i Faith, which really, really drives home the issue of oneness and the human family being one, same, all races being one race, and that's the you know, the race of the human family, and the oneness of God or the divine. So, in other words, there are many messengers coming from the divine, all with pretty much the same message, to the same people.
Right.
And, so that there's so much that we have in common and that can unite us, then that divides us. But somehow we're not getting the message. And I mean, I know how, I think most of us know how that are typically on this call. So that's what motivated me. You know, last conversation I heard him mention the beloved community. And I started really questioning, you know, whether that's possible, because I've been involved in that. So I actually have lots of experience in those environments.
Right.
So I
exactly.
said, you know, let's throw this out on the table and see how people feel.
Okay. All right.
Well,
yeah. Brother Pugh is online. And I know that, as you said earlier, he has talked extensively about the beloved community as well. And also, I recall, he had created a model of what he felt what a beloved community might look like. And so he's on, and I'm going to just ask him to sort of launch right in and give us his conclusions to this idea. Good afternoon, Brother Pugh. How you doing?
Well, good afternoon, Dr. Rogers and Sister Yanda. Thanks for the topic. You know, I think this topic is very, very, very appropriate.
Yes, it is.
The reason I think it's appropriate is that the world is undergoing a transformation mm-hmm. right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, of what's going on, it is going to be, it's simply not going to be possible after this pandemic to look at America in the same way. And so as a result, one of the things that happens with the people that essentially paralyzes them is this notion that fact is fate. In other words, people may not like the way things are, but they believe that things can't be any different than that. And as a result, they ignore the possibilities of change that are right around them. Well, when something like this happens, when you see a city like New York come to a complete standstill,
mm-hmm.
that tells you that it's possible for things to be different than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you're going to see, when you see the elevation of grocers at the end of this event, when you realize your life was saved by a delivery boy or a delivery girl, as opposed to, you know, this idea that, you know, all the people with the PhDs, these are the people who
mm-hmm.
matter.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize, no, the people who bring me my grocery, they're the ones who matter. The people who grow the grocery. In other words, there's going to be a transformation. But mm-hmm. let me just say that it's kind of hard for me to get into this, but in quick terms, Dr. King's beloved community is problematic, but the ideal of a beloved community, I mean, that's the way, well, actually, I call it the sacred world. That's how all creatures live on this planet. So that's how people live. But to achieve it, you would essentially have to transform America to that. And that's what Dr. King was attempting to do. And so I'm going to share it with this, but I'll give you a metaphor to sort of give you a sense of what I think the problem with Dr. King was. You saw today that a man died because he took, you know, some kind of coronavirus remedy that Trump told him, you know, would work. And he took it, and the stuff killed him. Well, what happened is that Dr. Fauci, after Trump, you know, said this thing, you know, is promising and all that, Dr. Fauci got up and rebutted what Trump said, but he did it in such a sophisticated and convoluted way that the message didn't register with the man. And so he and his wife, you know, they didn't even have symptoms. They took the poison basically and killed themselves. So I'm saying that when I look at Dr. King and I see all the different things that he has to say about love and power, I'm seeing elements of that ancestral wisdom in there. But it's in there in such a convoluted way with all kind of references to all kind of things that it's very easy for people to get it twisted like the young man did. And that's exactly what happened with Dr. King. And let me finish it with this. Lani Guinier, now to give you the story of Lani Guinier, she's the woman who Bill Clinton threw under the bus because she had written some stuff, you know, that the Republicans attacked. But she's also the one when Jesse Jackson came to the Democratic convention with delegates and he traded in his support for the Democratic Party. He said that what y'all need to change is this winner take all delegate selection process and change it to proportional delegate selection. And in fact, not just proportional, but any community that's really loyal to us, they should get more points than a suburban community that may vote with us sometimes, right? Well, because of that, Barack Obama was able to lose the state of Nevada and the state of Texas, but still beat Hillary Clinton because of the fact that he won the city of Las Vegas and the city of Houston, where they had rich votes. So that's who Lani Guinier is. Well, in 2006, Lani Guinier wrote a piece, and I had it here just for a second, and now I don't see it. She wrote a piece in 2006, an essay. It was called "From Racial Liberalism to Racial Literacy: Brown versus Board of Education and the Interest Divergence Dilemma." And what she was saying was that that the goal, that the model of beloved community that these people had come up with, that they had four elements to them. One of the things, they wanted to focus on the education of non-elite blacks. In other words, there were these poor blacks who needed to be educated. So let me tear down your schools and take your kids and give them a new education. The second element is that it was going to be focused on the legal system. That, in other words, remember Bayard Rustin talk about we're going to move from protest to politics, that we're going to go in the boardrooms now. We don't need to be out in the street. The third thing is that the fundamental problem is the hearts of white people. We need to eliminate personal prejudice. Right? And then the fourth element is that the goal is to achieve formal equality. That is to say that people cannot discriminate with, on us. In other words, it was called equality of opportunity. Right? Now, of course, we know that equality of opportunity don't mean equality of results. And so we can see that even though people may not cuss us out, that they can still have ugly outcomes planned for us, et cetera, et cetera. So I can go on and on. But the point is that the model that he had here's the final last thing. You could see that his model wasn't going to work because his model was the same model of the Weimar Republic in Germany. And the Germans, that's what Hitler and them was doing. They were basically, they had taken apart this kind of multicultural democracy model that they had in Weimar Germany, based upon individuals and all of that.
Right.
They had deconstructed that. Well, that's the same thing that happened with Dr. King's model. And so what I'm saying is that there is a model, but it's got to be organic. And okay. So I'll just let it go at that.
Okay. You know, in preparation for our discussion tonight, I decided to go back and look at various communities that were started. I guess in some cases, historians call them the utopian communities. And there have been hundreds of them that began in the 1800s at the first onset of the American system. And I think really as I look at some of them, I didn't read them all. I know some of them personally, like in terms of organization like the Shakers and like you said, some other Germans, the Mennonites and all of those. Those were supposedly these perfect communities that were going to be created. It appears that, as you said, the problem with a beloved community and in doing anything like that is that it's being built on a foundation that's weak. The American democratic system, democracy, is weak. There is no democracy here. And they were selling an illusion in starting this. When we go back and we look at the whole entry into the American colonies, it was based on an illusion. It was based on rich and powerful people. It wasn't going to ever be able to speak for all of the people. And then the bottom line is capitalism. Capitalism is the economic system that won't work like the description of a beloved community. And I think that's one of the biggest problems with doing that. But, I mean, I guess as you raise the question, I mean, it still has some merit. And there have been many communities and many organizations with African Americans that have tried to pull out and set up separate communities. But, again, the capitalist structure and all of its principles and ideas and all of the things that were with that pops up along with it. So I think that's what we have to look at. So, Sister Yah, let me ask you, did you have a vision of what a beloved community could look like? What were some of the platforms of it? You know, what about things like education? How would an educational system work in it? How would the economic system work in a beloved community? Because you would obviously have to focus on that.
Well, here's my issue. Not my issue, but here's some of the things that I actually saw. Because as I said, I had experience in two, but the Baha'i community and an actual organization called the Beloved Community. Their focus was more on Dr. King's vision of equality for all, these generic general terms,
right.
And just being happy to be able to hold hands and say we're brothers and sisters. There was not a deeper dive into what an alternative system, we're actually creating different systems, would look like. And so for a while that was nice and fuzzy feeling, and then I started looking at some of the realities and raising some questions and making some observations. And one thing I want to say, because again I want to speak from my experience,
right.
So no, there wasn't a deeper talks and discussions about, you know, alternative systems, and there was an avoidance of politics oftentimes, and an avoidance of the terrorism that black folk face.
Exactly.
So a lot of these communities are comprised of white folk, you know, white liberals who actually really want to do good. And I'm saying this because oftentimes, you know, when I speak with such passion about black empowerment and, you know, keeping reclaiming our African minds, as Dr. Bridges talks about. It may sound as if I hate all white people, because I've been accused of that, which I don't care, you know, what you accuse me of, because I'll tell you who I am.
Right.
I don't hate all white people. I hate white pathology. That's what I hate.
Okay.
And I hate the system that's been created that's just crushing people all over the world.
Right.
And so I observed that again, the fuzziness of just being, you know, black folk being happy to hold hands with white people, and how we oftentimes are looking for acceptance from whites. Or we finally reached that place where, you know, they accept us. I have a problem with that, because that means that you don't value yourself.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I've also, I really want to mention, put this on the table, in my involvement with these organizations, I observed a lot of black men that joined, finding it as an opportunity, or seeing it as an opportunity to marry and get involved with people other than black women. So that entering into and being accepted by and validated by white folks mean that, hey, I can, you know, have me a white woman now.
Okay.
You know, that's a very real thing that we observed and we talked about. Another thing I saw was, again, whites that were really sincere but very afraid of standing up to the system. That's why I talk about the fuzzy, happy feeling, because they live with these uncles and these grandfathers that hate the other, that hate Africans and hate every other.
That's true.
And so they know the level of violence and some of the pathology that's in the Caucasian, you know, gene. And so they're not going to fight too hard for you. And I think that's where, not I think, I've observed that that's where a lot of us are mistaken. We think that somebody else is going to fight for us in the way that we're supposed to fight for ourselves, and that's just not going to happen. Because as soon as they start to get a beat down, they're going to back off.
Right, right.
And that's what I observed. I observed other dynamics that I'll talk about later. But, yeah, no systems.
You know, and it's so interesting, because when you talk about building a new community, it kind of like, you know, it's like the example of saying all of the inmates in a prison are going to get together and build their own separate housing and living consideration in a system of captivity. How is that possible? You know, because at some point the power and the authority within that institution is going to step in and not allow anything to happen. I look at the Nation of Islam in terms of Honorable Elijah Muhammad's thoughts and work about developing his own nation right here in America. And I've never been able to see how that could take place. I can't see Caucasians allowing anybody to have that in a successful way, as we saw in Rosewood and saw in Tulsa and all those other cities where we attempted to try to live in a peaceful, beloved community. And they would tear it apart because they weren't pleased with doing that. And even King said that in his speech. He said, okay, he said, well, any other time you're freeing yourself from Egypt, he said, you can look for destruction to come. You can look for the replace. So how do you do that? How do you build a beloved community? And I think that's the question we're asking ourselves tonight. Those of you who are listening, who may be listening via the internet, if you have some points, some questions that you would like to raise, we welcome you to do that. As I said, this is the Black Reality Think Tank, and we would definitely appreciate any input that you could give. Our phone number here is a call-in number. Is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. And give us your thoughts. Brother White, is a beloved community possible in America for African-American people?
It's impossible for any non-white person to live peaceably with white people.
Okay.
I mean, if you look at the history of Europeans, any place that they have been, the people that they encountered was always worse off when they got there.
Yeah, I agree.
They've never lived harmoniously with anybody at any time. You know, I once said in a conversation I was having with people that the only good white person was a dead white person. And people, you know, said, well, you shouldn't say things like that. And I told them, that's not my opinion. That's a historical observation.
Observation, that's right.
If you take white out of the equation, and just don't call them white people, just describe their behavior and the things that they have done and say, if somebody did something like this, what should happen to them?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
That's all. Examine, put history on the witness stand. Examine their behavior. If I was to kidnap a man, a woman, and her daughter, and rape them and torture them, and then kill them, and I was caught and charged and found guilty, what would they do to me? What would you feel was an appropriate punishment for what I've done?
Right. Right. So, I think that's where it has to start in terms of looking at what's possible in doing that. And it also raises the question of, you know, just African people being here in this country and what the future lies. Because it's not going to go anywhere. It's not. I don't see that. I mean, I don't think their behavior is going to change in that way. You've seen the studies. You've seen what people have said about racism. First of all, they don't even want to acknowledge that they are racist. You know, that's one of the problems. And then, obviously, the behavior process. This very clearly, some of the things that we are seeing happening right now may have been perpetrated by individuals. It's not necessarily these are violations. I'm not saying that they are. But, you know, it's possible. And that's why I say I don't take anything off the table. And very clearly, you know, I think that's one of the pieces that we, you know, you have to look at and discuss.
If you look at what's going on right now and you say, well, this may have been done by, is that something that's unbelievable? Could you say, well, a white person would never do a thing like that?
No, you can't say that. No, sir. No, sir. Mm-mm. Not at all. You're right.
I got to say, I love this brother's, how candid he is. I just love it.
Oh, yeah, real brother. Brother White is raw.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, exactly right. You're right. I mean, it's time. It's that time. It's that time to tell the truth. You gotta bring that out. Let me ask Brother Timothy. Brother Timothy, what you think?
Well, to Sissy Ayan and Brother Q and Brother White, when they asked Malcolm when they would tie him down and they thought they could handcuff him, he would take the handcuff and jail them and tell them when he wanted them to come out. And they asked him, they said, the movement that you're in, is it racism? Malcolm said, no, I'm just teaching history. He said, I'm teaching the history of America and in the history of America. In America is racism, and huh?
No, I think there's somebody. I think there's somebody in the background. That's right. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll repeat it. I said when white folks would try to tie Malcolm down, he would take the tie and tie them up, handcuff them, and put them in jail and let them out when he wanted them out. And they asked him. They said, "In your movement, aren't you taught racism?" He said, "No, I'm just telling the history of America and white folks and what they have done."
Okay.
And if you go all the way back to David Walker's appeal to Delaney, to Martin Delaney, to Booker T. Washington, Garvey, to the messenger machine, which is only the Garvey machine, he tells you that land is important. Garvey tells you that land is important. Walker tells you who they are. And if you want to have peace, you have to have your own land. The thought is there. The people are here to make it happen because we cannot coexist with evil. People don't have our best intentions. We need our own schools, hospitals, businesses, social and economic order. And it can happen because in 1946, the Jews had an idea of a homeland. They have over 100 nuclear weapons, 400 jets, and they're always on the edge of losing it. And they'll tell you in a minute, if you try to take it from me, I'm going to take you down. So we have to come with that thought. Learn how to build for our own and have land that we can call our own. Garvey would agree. The messenger would agree, Walker would agree, and Delaney would agree.
Right. So this is kind of a dismal picture when you talk about future and ancestors. How do we frame this? I mean, you know, is this what we're going to hand our children and tell them this is what you got?
Let me jump in here. Is it okay, Doc?
Sure.
Go ahead. Or are you directing it to somebody else?
Go right ahead. Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Black folk, we've had a lot of fear instilled in us, you know, through torment. So that's a natural result of, you know, being tormented is becoming fearful. And it's been to our detriment because we have been afraid to, or many of us are afraid to face the fact that, yes, this is a pretty dismal picture here. You know, the future doesn't look bright. It really doesn't. And that's thanks to having, you know, a race of people who have a psychopathic gene, you know, who won't leave people alone. And the fact is, to Brother Timothy's point, we were doing just fine until the European came along. And whenever we separated, we did well. We built our own towns. We took care of ourselves. We took care of each other. Even though we were pumped with self-hatred, we still took care of each other after slavery. So whenever they're out of the picture and they're leaving us the hell alone, we do okay. But Black folk, we have this thing, I call it a Black codependent syndrome. And we have a tendency to want to save the world and hold hands with everybody. We want everybody to be equal and, you know, and love each other like Martin Luther King was saying. And it is a beautiful ideal. You know, I really want to get that across. I am not in disagreement with that. But it's just not possible because of these savage people that are on this earth.
Okay.
And we've experienced, you know, we've experienced so much pain in our efforts in trying to do that. You know that here in the South, and I talked about this a while ago, the Beloved Community Center here established the first Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the United States. Because prior to that, there was one in Africa. Everybody's familiar with the one that had been done in Africa, established in Africa. Well, there was one established in Greensboro, North Carolina. The first one in the United States. It may be the only one. I don't know. Right here.
Right.
And there was a big, big three-day convention, and people from all over the world came. And, I mean, it was just it was deep, you know. A lot of high-profile people came, and the organizers put the Klan. They put them on trial.
Okay.
You know, and this was related to the 1979 Greensboro massacre. Everybody's familiar with?
Oh, yeah.
The Klan shot five people, so killed four white people and one black person. And so out of that came the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. And so they were really trying to bring the truth to the light, you know, hold the Klan, a lot of the Klan's members who were still alive, hold them accountable, you know, take them to court and all this stuff. And that thing just flopped. It just flopped because the local government here would not hold the murderers accountable, even though, just like Rodney King, it was on film.
Okay.
And so we've seen enough of this to realize that to have to face the truth that we're dealing with some dangerous people. And unless we find a way to defend ourselves and whatever we build, it does look pretty dismal. So I would say we had better focus on whatever we do, how to protect ourselves.
Okay.
Because they won't let you live in peace.
Are we making a good argument then to embrace going back to what Marcus Garvey was doing and saying all the time? I mean, this sounds like the Garvey plan. I mean, it sounds like,
yes.
You know, is that what we're doing?
Yep.
Okay, I think you're right. I think it's obviously there has to come to some conclusion. You cannot do it here. As you have said tonight, Caucasians are not going to let you do that here because they're going to terrorize you, terrorize your children, terrorize your family. And they do it in strange ways. They don't necessarily, it doesn't have to be out all with the burning the cross and all of that stuff. They have other ways of doing it, suffering you, starving you, those kinds of things, and things that we can't control. And those of us who have knowledge and understanding sometimes are just not ready to stand up and challenge that. So it sounds like that's what we are doing. Let me go over here to Brother Oshie. How you doing tonight, Brother Oshie?
Hey, Doc, I'm doing well. How are you?
Okay, good, good. The beloved community, what do you think?
Well, you know, humanitarian ideas are great, and they're really nice. They're nice to talk about, to read about, to fantasize about, but the reality is something else. And given the history, as Malcolm said, of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward our research.
Right.
When you look at the history of Europeans and their involvement with people other than themselves, hell, they warred amongst themselves. They came out of that dark age, that medieval age, and said, we may war amongst ourselves, but we're going to all come together on those who are outside of us.
Right.
You know, and that's what they have done. They've gone around the world claiming everybody's stuff in the name of. They have been deeply influenced the whole damn planet, unfortunately. In fact, everybody wears a suit and tie in the world, don't they? Which is, of course, European. Everybody, very seldom do even people of other cultures wear their cultural attire because of the deep influence of the Western world.
Right.
And the Western world is selfish, greedy, very hardcore patriarchal,
yes.
You know. So there's no way, just as some of the other callers have said, you know, there's no way that we can live peacefully amongst them. So there's, you know, like I said, the idea of a beloved community is just that, a nice idea. But, you know, at the time that we were ruling the planet, even though the communications wasn't there, the visibility wasn't like all these things are today, but I would assure you, based upon my knowledge and my understanding of our history, we were welcoming. Doc gave the world the idea of a two-cradle theory of development, the northern cradle and the southern cradle. The southern cradle is being us. We're gynophilic. We're very giving. We're understanding. Complementarity, male-female complementarity,
right.
You know, egalitarian, all of these positive things. And so when people came into Kemet, they studied at our feet. The Greeks studied at our feet, even though they came back later as conquerors and then pleasurized everything. Okay, it's another time they messed up. And then, again, when they came out of that dark age, that medieval age, they sat at the feet of the Moors. And for 700 years, the Moors taught them how to live, you know.
Sure did.
And get them cattle and stuff out of the castle, you know, take a bath and so forth. You know, so twice, we have assisted their development.
Right.
And then the
ultimate was
to deny our humanity. The ultimate was to deny who we are as a people, our intelligence. I'm going to tell you, I'm with Bonisiwa and others. I don't hate anybody. But damn it, I hate a system that has been created by the European giving himself a top position with everybody else a lower position, with us at the lowest position. It has been something that is around the damn world. And almost a lot of the cultures, they, you know, even though they have a melanated people, the only people you see on damn it TV are those who look most Caucasian.
Right.
In Thailand, everywhere, in Brazil. They got more Africans in Brazil than Nigeria. But we don't know nothing there either. So I'm saying this is what has happened because of European, as I call it, I don't call it white supremacy, I call it European Caucasian extremism. Because they're not superior. And they ain't white. They ain't white. But they created that idea of whiteness and calling themselves white. And then what does the dictionary say about them as being white? And what does it say about us being black? See, we have to understand what we're dealing with. That's our problem. We don't understand who we're dealing with.
That's true.
So therefore,
we really don't know who we're dealing with. You're right. You're right.
Right. And so we come to the table thinking that there's going to be some kind of respect for our humanity and our opinions. But it's no. Hey, brother, I'm going to end with this, and I'll continue to listen. And hope you let me in again. But anyway, it's like this. It's mind over matter.
Yeah.
They don't mind doing to us what they have done to us and continue to do to us because why? We don't matter.
Right.
We don't matter.
So I know you have promoted the idea of repatriation.
Almost definitely.
Yeah. And so
most definitely.
Is that possible?
It's the only solution.
Is a beloved community possible in the repatriation idea that you have? If so, how do you see that? Is a beloved community possible in the repatriation movement? But let me finish. Considering sometimes the state of Africa and how Europeans have gone to Africa and destroyed it.
Yes,
most definitely. Okay.
Because that beloved community has to be within ourselves. We have to begin to respect ourselves, trust each other, love each other, be willing to work with each other. I know and you know Africa is a damn mess.
Right.
Despot, neo-colonialist, all kinds of foolishness, craziness. Europeans still at a hard hold on many of the countries and their currencies, particularly the French.
Right.
The Chinese, Chinese are planning to plant 100 million people. Well, hell, they got 1 billion people, so 100 million people is a tenth of what their population is. But still, you know, they plan to plant 100 million people. But the beloved community, that's what must happen in Africa. Pan-Africanism or perish.
Right.
Unify or die. That's my mantra, brother.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, you know, and you're right. I mean, very clearly that has to happen. I was reading an article the other day talking about how much wealth and power the French have in Africa. What they're controlling. Like we talk about the Chinese, but it's really the French really controlling a lot of those natural resources and and how this deal done that. So. I guess as we think about that, how can that be done? I mean, how do you see it being done? Because I know that there are some movements to address.
And, right.
Yeah.
There's a Pan-African Federalist Movement, the United African States. By next year, the big conference is next year in Addis Ababa. You know, but I think that considering all the things that are happening, this is the movement. This is the time. And if it doesn't happen, I think it's over for us. I'm serious.
Okay.
If it doesn't happen, I think it's over for us as African people. Because the only thing that we truly can claim is Africa. That's why, to me, the Republic of New Africa, Nation of Islam, and others who wanted to have some land here, talking about separate here, you can't do that in the midst of an open and sworn enemy. Look at the history once again. You know?
Yep.
And I just returned from... Tulsa, Oklahoma, a couple weeks ago,
uh-huh.
You know, looking at firsthand what evil, mean-spirited sons of guns, you know, have done to the community. You know, that's why, to me, it wasn't a riot.
Right.
It was a massacre. It was destruction. And I think that was a problem with what happened with their lawsuit and the ability to get, some kind of restitution. The kind of reparations.
Exactly.
So they definitely deserve it because it was documented. These people lived there, you know? This is not something. They lived there. Their property was stolen. Their property was burned to the ground. Members of their family were murdered. They weren't put in detention camps. All these things happened. They literally bombed the city from the air.
Yeah.
These things happened.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
So I think that given that understanding and given the history and the fact that we have a history that says we have done it before. So it's not like we can't do it again.
Okay.
It is our will. That's why Marcus Garvey was so correct.
He was.
Up you mighty
That's right.
people, you can accomplish what you will.
Right. Let me go over here to Brother Pugh. I know, Brother Pugh, you had created a model. And I noticed on the Knowledge is Power website, you just put something up about that model. But why don't you tell us, you know, just while we're listening and while we're talking about this, Obviously, the model that you created, you obviously have some idea that it could work here. Am I correct in saying that?
Well, it can work anywhere, and you can live in harmony with white people. And I can deconstruct every argument that y'all have made. Okay. But obviously, it'll take a little time. And by the way, I do it with a framework that is based upon stuff that, in other words, I'm not a preacher. I'm not saying some stuff that, you know, came to me through a revelation.
Right.
I'm using understandings and insights that each of you personally have, and will show you that the things you're talking about are not true and cannot be sustained.
Okay.
What the essay that I was talking about. Well, and by the way, if you want, in fact, the best way to understand what it means to live in harmony with another people is just think about the relationship between wolves and deer. Now, there's no question that wolves eat deer, but right. Wolves and deer can live in harmony with each other. And there are two rules that you got to have to be able to live in harmony, even with your enemy. That one rule is limits, and the other rule is periodicity. In other words, if there are limits and rules, you can live with your enemy. So when you see this rapper, Fat Joe, that say it ain't no rules and it ain't no limits, then that means that he's going on a trajectory that makes it impossible for him to live with any other human being. Because it means that if there are no limits, that means no matter how much I got, I need to get some more. And if there are no rules, then that means that whatever agreement I make with you, I don't need to keep that. Well, it turns out that having that mindset, which, by the way, unfortunately, that comes from Alexander the Great, who got it. He was a 22-year-old. So the world we live in now is a world based on ideas that Alexander at 22 got from Aristotle, right? So, and by the way, that, you know, so let me just go to you asked about the model that I have.
Yeah, the model you have.
What the model was about was Amos Wilson talked about the falsification of African consciousness. And so, you know, you can read a whole lot of books, but at the end of the day, I'm always interested in simplifying what folks are saying and making it plain. And so at the end of the day, what he said is that when you look at the black community, what you're going to find is, he said there are five pathologies, but it's really four, and the fifth one comes as a result of the other four. The fifth one is called delusion, this idea of thinking you're somebody who you're not. But the first four are the critical ones that my model talks about, that talks about what it means to build a community. The first delusion is anxiety. Anxiety. I'm just without even thinking of bringing it up. But
someone in the background. Go ahead. Uh-huh.
Right. Let me do just a little setup. When you talk about a community, what you're talking about are, there are six elements of a community. There are children, there are youth, there are adults, and there are elders. And they're centered on their ancestors. That tells them about the place that they exist in the world. And what determines whether they can live in the future is their unborn. So those are the six dimensions of a community. And what sustains a community is that each of these institutions, the institution of the child, the institution of the youth, the institution of the adult, and the institution of the elder, they have to be defended. They have to be protected. And so what we see today in our community, y'all are familiar with Black Lives Matter. Fundamentally, when your argument is that you should have a right to live, you're defending the institution of the child. The program No Child Left Behind, when your argument is that you should have a right to education, you're defending the institution of the youth.
Okay.
The program Affirmative Action, which says you should have a right to income, self-sustaining income, you're defending the institution of the adult. And finally, the program Black Power, and, you know, the whole ideal of driving while black and so on, these are people who live, got an education and got a job, and now they're living their life the way they want to live it. But that But the way they're living is being challenged, and that's why you need Black power. Well, now you're defending the institution of the elder, right? Okay. And so what my model says then is it says it imagines you as a cultural doctor. And it says, well, look, I'm going to do a diagnosis of my community and ask the question, is my community healthy? Because if it's healthy, then that means that we have the ability of, you know, what they call it, self-definition, self-determination, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That, in other words, we have these four freedoms, the freedom from fear, which is a defensive freedom and an offensive freedom. We have the freedom to speak, that is the freedom to speak within our community and to speak out to other communities. We have the freedom from want, the ability to produce what we need to survive, and the ability to consume what we produce. The Irish people produced all kind of food, and they were starving because they were forced to take the food that they could produce and give it to the English. Okay. And finally, the freedom to worship. And the freedom to worship has nothing to do with no Jesus Christ and no Holy Ghost and no other world. Worship has to do with the ability to change your world as you need to, because everything is dynamic and everything is alive. And so you're going to have to make adjustments. And that's what elders do, is make adjustments to their community to keep it as a circle of life.
So let me make sure I understand, so we can, because I want to go back. So you're saying that in this model, recognizing these points that you've made and you can put them in place, can then override any objection, any infiltration from unwanted behavior. All of that will do away with that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I would put it in these terms. One of, you know, Gil Scott-Heron in the song "Winter in America,"
right?
He says, "Ain't nobody fighting because nobody knows what to change," right? Well, one of the things that you're doing when you do strategic thinking is you recognize what's important for you, what your important objectives are. And so once you realize that you're trying to defend the institution of the child, once you realize you're trying to defend the institution of the youth, then you realize that, okay, I've got enemies. We're fighting now a virus. That's an enemy. And you've got a system that's designed to deal with your enemies. That's just a part of the way things are. In fact, that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. That's the way things are designed. And so, yes, but what it says is that rather than being distracted and diverted, that you recognize that, hold it, you know, what I've got to do is do this. So let me get back to the model. So what it says, that if you're a doctor and you're saying, in other words, now, it may be the case that in order for your community to be free, because, by the way, if you're not united, you're not going to be free. And if you're divided, you're going to be ruled by somebody else. So ultimately, you want to be united. And that's, in fact, the young man had an interesting model. And I think Oshie was talking, said something the other day that I thought related to it. It begins with self-knowledge. You take self-knowledge, and that enables you to have solidarity with people who are like you. That solidarity enables you to sustain separation with people, with these people that you have solidarity with. And finally, with that separation, you can develop sovereignty. Now, the process of going from one place to the other may take time. It may even be generationally, right? But at least you're clear about the goal. I gave the example the other last week, where at the end of the Civil War, we strategically said we want our women educated. And whether or not the education of Black women was a good thing or not, we achieved that goal. Black women are the most educated group in America right now. That was a goal we set. Now, whether or not it was a good goal, et cetera, that was a goal and we achieved it. It took generations to do it.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is that, let me just summarize.
Yeah, please do,
so
because we only got a little bit more time. I need to.
Right. So if you're the doctor and you look at the institution of the child, you ask a little five-year-old child what he wants to be in his life. And if the child starts talking about what he wants to be and you got to shut him up, then you know that's a healthy child. If, on the other hand, the child starts talking about what he can't be, then you know that's an unhealthy child and somebody's going to put fear in him and he's got a problem and you need to do the diagnostics to figure out what to do with the child that has fear. He's right. The equivalent of the elephant who's had his leg tied to a pole, and then when you take the chain off his leg, the elephant thinks he can't move, right?
But I think, and I hear you. But you started your plan by talking about the fact that the deer and the wolf, you know, are natural born enemies. And what you were saying is that I'm thinking that you were going to say your plan can make the deer and the wolf live together. And
I'm saying the deer and the wolf live together right now. They're enemies right now, and they live together right now. So I'm not saying, in fact, the beloved community, that's what's going on with the lions and the hyenas. They're doing that right now. That's how they get down. In fact, beyond the beloved community is something called the sacred world. The jungle is a sacred world.
Okay.
Right? So the notion that everybody is your friend, no, you can coexist in your body right now. There are any number of organisms who are antagonistic towards you, who are part of your survival. So it's not a question of everybody's on your side. You've got to, in fact, in order for your body to stand up, you got to have, you talk about isometrics. You got to have forces that are opposing each other in order to stand up. So the notion that there's some kind of harmony where everything is moving as one. In fact, that was one of the problems with Dr. King's model and the Shakers and all these others. They had these synthetic abstract models where they thought they can just theorize something from the top of their head and then cause it to manifest in the world.
But in your beginning, you did say that was incorrect, that we couldn't live together. You said that we can live together.
I'm saying we can live together, right.
But
you need to understand what live together means. Now, if you mean live together, meaning that, in other words, it is possible for me to coexist with you, but you've got your world and I got my world. In fact, just give you an example. We already know that in terms of families, you coexist with your son's family, and you coexist with the neighbor next door, but you ain't running his house, and you're not running your son's house. But you coexist with him, right? There are things that you interact around. There are also things you disagree around. So it is possible to coexist, but the first thing that you've got to have is that the entities that you're coexisting with, they have to have limits. In other words, the trajectory of their culture has to be a circle.
Okay.
They have to have limits and they have to have rules. If they have that, I don't care who they are.
Okay.
You can live with
it. I'm a little confused. Let me go over here to Sister Yan. Sister Yan, are you picking up what? Because I want to ask you from the position, is he says that it's incorrect to say that we can't live with white people, and his model is suggesting that maybe what we mean by can you live together is incorrect. Now, King said it in terms of the fact that we can live together in harmony. And harmony means that if I'm at the water hole drinking water and I'm the deer, that you the wolf, you shouldn't be bothering me. Don't bother me. I'm drinking water just like you are, so leave me alone. But I'm not picking that. That's what we're going. We're going to come back to Brother Pugh and ask him to explain that. But what do you think, Sister Yan? Because I know that kind of is in line with what you are thinking as you talked about King's beloved community. What do you think?
Okay, so one of the reasons, the other reason that I brought up the topic of a beloved community is that I have noticed, as an organizer, as a person who's dealt with, I've interacted and organized with so many different types of people, Persians, you know, Iranians, Puerto Ricans, Black, African,
right.
You name it. I spent many years with white folk. Many years, and I'm speaking as a pan-Africanist, as a cultural nationalist. I've spent many years in personal relationships, and those have been my greatest teachers, my experiences. That is the absolute truth, that experience is the greatest teacher. And I'm talking about hundreds of people over several decades. So I noticed that white Caucasians, they have an issue that we really need to understand. And somebody said it earlier. I think that most of us don't understand who and what we're really dealing with. And that's that, in my experience, white folk will always have fear of black folk because they are afraid of black anger. and be, and even the liberals, of course, the, so whatever these you want to label people, the white evangelicals, they are evil evangelicals, they are evil as hell, and conservatives, et cetera, they are afraid of black anger. And the only way that we would be able to live with them, which I have no interest in doing, by the way, I don't want my children, my nieces, my elders to live with someone who has hostile intentions toward them. But the only way that we would be able to live with them is through assimilation. That's why they push assimilation for everyone, like Brother Oshie was talking about. All over the world, you know, people dress like them. They push their culture onto people. And that way they feel like you're not a threat. But if you dare to not be what they want you to be, then you're a threat. And then they're out to destroy you. That's the bottom line. I heard that over and over again. Whites are afraid of black men unless they're feminized or assimilated.
Okay. All right.
And appear to be non-threatening, smiling, you know, I love everybody, let's hold hands and whatnot. And they are increasingly afraid of angry black women. Okay. But see, now that they've been very successful in removing black men from the community, black women are having to stand up now.
Uh-huh.
And black women are angry. And we are ready for a revolution. We're ready to fight because they're killing our babies.
Yeah,
I don't know if everybody's seen that video of the six-year-old girl, 6 years old, who was handcuffed and put in
that.
A police car.
Yeah, sure did.
Black women are in an outrage.
Okay.
We can't live with that.
Let me go over here and ask Oshie. Oshie, Brother Pugh said that he said that he thinks that he can. There is a possibility that the wolf can live with the deer,
with the sheep. Huh? No, well, I mean, we're all expressing, you know, some concepts that we, you know, believe in, and some. But I don't give you my opinion. Same.
Okay.
Deeply profane. I'm not talking about what I try to do is give you the perspective and the opinion of our ancestors, our scholars, our historians, our elders, who were not assimilationists, who were not in going along to get along. These men and women understood what we're dealing with. They understood. Dr. Amos Wilson, and you mentioned Amos Wilson, you know, Amos Wilson clearly understood. In fact, one brother said, if you want to talk about black psychology, you're a psychiatrist or a psychology, have you read the work of Amos Wilson? If the person hasn't read the works of Amos Wilson, he said, man, I ain't going to deal with you.
Right,
you know?
Right.
See, so, but I'm, you know, I love Dr. John Henry Clark, Dr. Ben,
right.
John G. Jackson, all of them, all of our scholars, all of the brothers and sisters who understood that we must do for ourselves.
Yes.
There is no way. There's nothing we can do. Europeans suffer from cognitive dissonance. They believe that they're superior. And a damn thing that we can say or do to prove otherwise. In fact, they don't want to hear it. That's what cognitive dissonance is here.
Right.
They don't want to hear it. They have this concept that even if it is said, it threatens us. So they deny it. They ignore it. They dismiss it. So you had this Caucasian woman, D'Angelo, who was doing these workshops, and these folks didn't want to hear it. So she came up with this other phrase, white fragility.
Okay.
They're fragile.
Okay.
Meaning when they're confronted with them, they don't want to hear it. And you know what? They sure in the hell don't want to hear from us.
No, they don't.
Imagine they want to hear from white folks.
Right.
You know?
Let me go over here to...
let me think I'm Doc.
Okay.
Can I think I'm Doc?
Okay. Go right
think
ahead.
I'm Doc.
Go right ahead.
Okay.
One minute. There's some background noise.
I know it is. I am trying to eliminate that. Go ahead, Brother Timothy.
Oh, yes, Doc. You have to go back and watch Malcolm in his debate when he talks about the wolf and the fox. Malcolm said that the wolf is more aggressive to the lamb, and eventually the wolf gets the lamb chopped. But he said the fox is sly, and he will deceive the lamb until he gets the lamb chopped.
if you look at Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, she constantly reminds you that the black man has a germ inside of him where white folks won't be able to reproduce because of her eggs and her ovum and her reproductive system. When the baby's born, the baby is of color. And what the white man will see in the black woman if he reproduces with her. They have a fear of a black planet.
Yeah.
So like Malcolm said, he said, the fox is sly, but the wolf is more aggressive. But they both want what? The lamb chop.
Right. Okay. Let me just, 917-662. Do you have a comment?
Hello? Yeah. Personally, I'm for total separation of the races. It's the only way we're going to achieve the community we're speaking about. Because Bobby Wright said there's only three ways you can deal with a psychopath.
Okay.
That is sedate, incarcerate, or kill. I'm for the latter myself. And that's the only way we're going to achieve that beloved community that we're speaking about. Because,
right,
as Brother White said, just put history on trial. Anywhere they went, they've caused death, destruction, and domination. And I think it's a waste of time to try to even convert them to be, because they can't be humane to nobody. They've proven that time and time again.
Right.
Like Malcolm X said, the sheep got a better chance of integrating with wolves than we get integrating with white folks.
Yeah.
And I like to mention this as an after. We lost Brother Dr. Leo out of Africa.
Yeah.
A couple of days ago, and I think we ought to, you know, give him a moment of silence, because he dedicated his life to the health and nutrition of black people.
Yeah.
I say,
yep. Okay, 919-477. 919-477, your comment, remarks? Okay, all right. Brother Pugh, I'm going to come back over to you.
Before you do that, Doc, you actually interrupted me. I don't know if you...
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. Well, there's a lot of people on board, and they're trying to get on. I'm trying to let some of them on there. Okay, but go ahead.
When you get a chance, I'd like to complete my thought. Let me just say that.
No, go right ahead. I'm going to open it up. I'm going to go back to Brother Pugh, because he said that he can refute a lot of the ideas that folks have that we can't live together. So I want to...
Right. And so I want to respond to that. I think it's really, really pointless for us to debate and argue about these things because everybody on a call is pretty much, and that's everybody, has talked about our experience here. And again, experience is the best teacher. Our experience in America, and when we look across the globe, white domination has created chaos, death, and destruction. And so the question is, how do we address that? And what I was going to say earlier is that I've come to see that whether it's Republican, I'm talking about black people now, Republicans, however they identify, Pan-African, whatever, our beloved community, we actually have the same desire, and that's to be empowered as black people.
Mm-hmm.
The question, again, is how we get there. And I don't think, well, let me say, I wouldn't waste my time anymore trying to convince somebody to become a cultural nationalist or whatever. But I do think it's critical that we understand the enemy that we're dealing with. And then some people may think twice about how they're thinking. You know, for instance, MLK, when he talked about, you know, holding hands and loving each other and, you know, beloved community and whatnot, he also later on said that he had to reconsider and wonder if he was integrating his people into a burning house.
Right.
And we all know that.
Right.
So, you know, oftentimes the deeper we get into white pathology and understand its mechanisms and the thinking of that brain, that psychopathic brain, the more troubling, you know, it is,
mm-hmm,
when you really realize what you're dealing with. And we can't change that.
Okay.
There may be a few, but we can't change that. We have to change ourselves because we have really been damaged. And as much as we talk about what white pathology has done to us, we still have to always keep in mind that we have to heal ourselves so that we can create our own beloved community.
Right.
That's true.
Okay, Brother Pugh, now you said that you said you think you could kind of refute some of those ideas and say that we can live together and that it's not the situation. I don't want to put words in your mouth, so maybe you just kind of reiterate that.
Yeah, exactly. Now it'll take a second, but I'm going to give a couple frameworks. The first framework, with respect to those people arguing from history and claiming that, you know, that they've got some kind of, they've looked at history, and some people got these histories of a couple hundred years, and some people, I guess they go a thousand years and so on. I would suggest to them that, you know, if you go and look at an iceberg, you would assume that the iceberg is not moving at all. And so what you need is some kind of sophisticated way of looking at that iceberg to determine that the thing is actually moving, even though it appears not to be moving. The second thing is with respect to the vision of what it means to live in harmony with someone. I just told you that the jungle is a beloved community, and those lions and hyenas kill each other upon sight. So it ain't a question of you holding hands with somebody. That's not what living in harmony with somebody is. I gave the example of the wolves and the deer live in harmony. What it means is that you have your circle of life, they have their circle of life, and these circles they intersect at certain points. The third point, the Bobby Wright psychopath thesis. Well, first of all, white people are not psychopaths. Donald Trump is a psychopath, but if all white people were, by the way, a psychopath is a person that's narcissistic, that is sadistic, that is Machiavellian, and, you know, there's another one. In other words, it is not possible for other people, even white people, to coexist with psychopaths. What has to happen when you got a psychopathic leader, the other people have to be sociopaths. They have to give up their will and submit to the will of the psychopath. I say that if you look at the history of white people as an iceberg, and you look at change, you'll realize that white people have changed. They have not always had the value system that they're currently having. And in fact, one of the arguments, you know, that most people, you know, are espousing is this is fascism. This comes from what happened is that Germans were concerned that they were losing their power to the English and the French, and they began to deconstruct the Enlightenment. And the way they deconstructed the Enlightenment was this whole notion of friend versus foe, and it's impossible for even white people to coexist with each other. And that's the mentality of the Trumps and those kind of people.
Okay.
Now, there are any number of misconceptions and so on that Europeans have, which, by the way, is based on the Egyptians. The pyramid is a pyramid of death. That's not a circle of life. In other words, the only way you can get to live as large as they live, you got to conquer some people to do that, right? Now, you can claim, just like the Europeans, now talk about educating, we educated them in our temples. Well, guess what? People come to New York and Berkeley and whatnot to get an education. And you made the point that the Europeans are some of the most rapacious people in the history of the world, but they got intellectual power because knowledge is a crime. And so, you know,
okay. All right, let me, if there's
any specific question, let me ask that because there's so many elements to the
I know. Let me go over here to Brother Marcus. Brother Marcus, any thoughts?
Yes, my brother, Dr. Rogers.
Thank you.
My brother, Luke. 400 years is long enough to know if there was any human relationship to be worked out with these people. We could have done it in 400 years. So history demonstrates that these people have no intention of working out anything with black people,
mm-hmm.
unless we're at the bottom. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to build no black empire here in America. You're not going to build no utopian society here in America with these white folks. You got to separate yourself and go build. Our issue is not getting along with white folks. Our issue is getting along with each other. That's our problem. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying get it along with each other. To hell with white folks. They have demonstrated time and time again that they don't care nothing about you. So the sooner we make a 180-degree turn and go build our empire, the better off we'll be. See? Right. We have no friends as black people. And unfortunately, right, at this time, we have very few friends within.
Right.
See? We spend too much time trying to get along with these people. These people don't care nothing about us.
Right.
Our the prize is Africa. That's where we're going to build our empire. That's where we're going to build our utopian society.
Like,
and the black man from the West has to step up to the plate, and because we are the most detribalized Africans on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
We here in the West, especially right here in America, because living with this European has made us an expert on dealing with him. See? We know him. He has no redeemable character. This man is a megalomaniac, a kleptomaniac, a homicidal, a pathological liar. How the hell are you going to live with that?
Okay.
How are you going to live with that?
Okay.
Come on, Dr. Pugh. Do better than that. You're an intelligent man. Come on, man. Please.
Okay. I'm going to come back to you, Brother Pugh. Don't worry. I'm going to come to you. Thank you so much, Brother Marcus. Let me go over here to my brother from Montgomery, Alabama, 334.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Good evening.
You know, I'm going to join in with Brother Marcus in that, how do we do the beloved community? What is it that we need to do? And Brother Oshie, if you're still with us, I wanted to really connect with you over in Atlanta. I'm right a few hours away from you in Montgomery, to be able to try to do this thing we call the beloved community. What is it that we need to do to actually put things in place to create this? And so the doing part is where I think I am right now, establishing the connection, being able to dialogue, sort of like what we're doing here. Being able to exchange with each other. I give, they take, I give, et cetera. And so what is it really that we need to do in order to get this beloved community going? And so that's where, that's the perspective from which I come from.
And that's clearly the question we are asking, and that is why the discussion. And I'm going to share your number with Brother Oshie as well. I'm going to bring him on. Brother Oshie, what's your response to this? I want you to particularly, if you could, respond to Brother Pugh saying that we're using history in sort of an incorrect way to assess this whole idea. How do you see that?
Well, you know, I always like to say, you know, it's ludicrous to argue with each other of us about being independent, self-determining, liberated, sovereign. Because what we should be talking about is how do we achieve it? What are the things that we need to do to work on it? If you don't believe that that's what we should be, then, you know, then go ahead. But to me, the only thing that we should be striving for is to be a sovereign people, to determine our own destiny,
okay,
to control our own land, our own resources, our own people, our own thoughts, our education. We have so much work to do on the continent. We have so much work to do, you know.
Okay.
We have roads to be made, ports, highways, schools, hospitals, energy sources, sewage systems. There's so much infrastructure, so much work to be done. And we need as many people and intelligent people and people willing to work to do it.
Okay.
And so to me, that's the reality for us. Those are the things that we need to start talking about.
Well realistically, realistically, you're talking about a next generation kind of process, correct? So how do we get which is our young people, how do we get them moving toward being able to see what you just said? Because I totally agree with you. But I guess that's what Brother Lutz is asking. How do we begin to move in that direction to get out of that?
We have to do, obviously, that, you know, the educational process, the educational system that we're under, you know, we have to do something independent of that. So even if we send our children to the public schools, private schools, whatever, we develop educational schools, just like the European.
This call may be recorded or transcribed.
Then we will be able to do it.
Okay. I hear you. Okay.
A lot of background noise.
Yes, a lot of background. Yeah.
Doc, are you working on something?
No, there's somebody that's an interference.
Dr. Rogers?
Yeah. Oh, can you hear me?
Hello?
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me?
Can everybody else hear me?
I hear you. Ayana, I can hear you. This is Theodore.
Okay, I think Doc said he has some issues that he was trying to work on.
So you go on. Okay. You go on now.
If I may speak while we're trying to get ourselves together.
Yes.
Brother Oshie, this is Brother Theodore in Montgomery.
How you doing,
there something, and it's a pleasure to finally talk with you. I'm sorry I wasn't able to get with you earlier. Is there a connection that you can help me with someone on the continent to be able to begin a dialogue or an exchange with them?
I have some connections in Ghana. I'll give you my number. And you can give me a buzz, and I can see what I can do for you, my brother. Sure, of course.
I've got his. Can you hear me now? Can everybody hear me?
All right. Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah. It's interesting while we're on the phone. There's an interference that comes in, and there actually is an individual whose name appears up here. And anytime that name appears, something happens. So I'm just letting you know.
You got to mute them.
And I don't really know who it is, and it's
you can't mute it, Doc.
I've even tried to do that; I couldn't do it. So it's something. There's a person. Now he just went off. The person just went off. So that's obviously. Every time he comes on, something happens. It messes up the system. It says he's coming out of Philadelphia. So I'm not sure who that is and what that's all about.
I'm still hearing something sounds like heart breathing or
something. Yeah, there's something. Yeah, I don't know what that is either. I've been hearing that, and I can't. It's a loud. It sounds like somebody breathing or something. And it's just really distorting everything.
But everything's fine right now.
Well, I just muted where I thought it was back on again. Yeah, I think there's some manipulation going on here. But anyway, let's continue because we only got about 10 minutes left. I didn't hear the part. I want to open up and let Brother Pugh respond to some of the comments that have been made at this point. Brother Pugh?
Right. Let me quickly speak to him. With respect to Brother Lush, what can we do? Well, the model that I posted on there that talks about community health and whatnot, that's the model that's based on Amos Wilson's idea. I mean, it talks about what it actually takes to build a healthy community. So anything you're going to do is going to have to be because you've got human beings who function as a community. The second thing, with respect to Brother Marcus, who talked about 400 years is enough, I would suggest to him, if you look at the Vikings who conquered the Inuit people in about 400 A.D., they assumed they were superior to the Inuit people. Well, in 1400 A.D., they had starved to death. So some things take longer to manifest themselves. With respect to Oshie, that talks about working on the continent, I would remind them of the history of Liberia, of blacks coming over there and having the mentality that whites had that they left with, or for that matter, Toni Morrison's book, Paradise, that talked about blacks who were concerned that they were discriminated against by both whites and light-skinned blacks, and so they were going to start them a black community. And what they found is that the same pathology that they thought they were leaving, they brought that with them. And then the final thing, we got Toni Morrison. Oh, and the final thing is with respect to Africa, everybody agrees that Saddam Hussein, I think he had the fifth biggest army in the world. They wiped him out. Muammar Gaddafi had one of the largest gold reserves on the planet. He had one of the most democratic societies that's ever been implemented. He was wiped out. So the notion that you can simply autonomously come up with, you know, whatever you want without dealing with the geopolitical realities is absurd. I'm saying that the first thing you have to do is you have to create a basis for coexistence with other people. In fact, that's the same thing the Europeans are doing. They're right now, they're concerned about what are we going to do with China. In other words, we want to be king of the hill, and they want to be king of the hill, and we can't both be king of the hill. So the point is that you've got to have diplomacy with other people. And so we're talking about coexistence. We're not talking about you eliminating your traditions to embrace theirs. We're just saying that it's possible for you to coexist with people who have traditions that are different than yours.
I want to jump in here before.
Can you all hear me now? Sister Young, can you? Are you all able to hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm sorry about that. That problem is still existing. Somebody's knocking this thing off. But anyway. We're at the end. We're at at the closing time. I really think that this was a dynamic discussion. I will put this online sometime this week, and you'll be able to hear this conversation again. I thank all of you for coming on. This is obviously a continuing discussion. I had to come back on via telephone. I'm actually calling you via phone because it knocked off all of the systems. So I'll put this on. We'll convene again next Tuesday. I'm going to try to see if I can get to the bottom of this, where this is coming from. But by all means, everybody, be safe. Please play it safe. And we'll see you next Tuesday, okay?